So first of all, thank you to the organisers for putting together a really great conference. It's been a really interesting week. And I'm very excited now to have the opportunity to talk to you about some recent work I carried out with my collaborator, Marcos. And first off, I just want to admit at the start, there's not going to be any holography or quantum gravity in this talk. So apologies to anyone who's disappointed by that. But instead, I'm going to be telling you about a project we did where we used ideas from high-energy physics, so in particular supersymmetric quantum mechanics, and used them to derive new results in quantum complexity theory. So more precisely, we took some insights from supersymmetric quantum mechanics and used them to study a classical problem in computational topology. And what we found was that this problem, well, the complexity of this problem, that's been an open question for kind of over 20 years now, should actually be understood by considering quantum complexity classes, which is kind of at first quite a surprising result because this, you know, at first sight, this problem looks entirely classical. So, you know, you might be wondering, why is this problem quantum mechanical? Or what, you know, why is the complexity of this problem best understood by quantum complexity classes? And the answer really comes from supersymmetric quantum mechanics. So first of all, what is this problem? And the problem we're going to be talking today is known as the clique homology problem. So first of all, what do I mean by homology? Well, homology is the study of holes and manifolds. And today, this is a kind of complexity talk, so we want to phrase homology as a computational problem. And the way we're going to do that is assume that we're given as the input to our computational problem some description of a manifold and an integer L. And the question we want to answer is, does this manifold that we were given as input have an L-dimensional hole? And for now, just think about holes in your normal kind of intuitive way you'd imagine a hole. I'll define them mathematically slightly later in the talk. Okay, so this is the homology problem. Today we're not going to be interested in kind of completely general homology problem. Instead, we're going to be interested in the homology problem when the kind of input geometrical object is a simplicial complex. So you can think of a simplicial complex as being kind of a discretization of a manifold. So more precisely, a simplicial complex is a geometrical object that's formed out of building blocks called simplices, where a zero simplex is just a vertex, a one simplex is an edge, a two simplex is a triangle, a three simplex is a tetrahedron, and so on to higher dimensions. We can't really visualize these simplices in higher dimensions, but we can, define them mathematically completely consistently. So the question we're interested in today is, does a simplicial complex have an L-dimensional hole? So for example, you can see this simplicial complex here has two one holes, where a one hole is a hole that's kind of bounded by one simplices, and one two hole, where a two hole is a simplicial complex, a hole that's bounded by two simplices or triangles. This is a simplicial homology problem. But we're not even going to try and tackle this for all simplicial complexes. We're going to restrict our attention to a particular class of simplicial complexes called independence complexes, which are defined by a graph. So to construct an independence complex from a graph G, what you need to do is find all the k independent sets of G. And you then construct a simplicial complex out of these independent sets. So the naught simplices in your simplicial complex, or the vertices in your simplicial complex, are going to be all the independent sets of this graph. And that just means all the vertices of the graph. The one simplices, or the edges in your simplicial complex, are going to be given by all the two independent sets of this graph. So that's all the pairs of vertices that don't share an edge. The two simplices, or the triangles, in your independence complex are going to be given by all the three independent sets of your graph. So that's all the sets of three vertices, such that no two vertices share an edge. And you can see how this goes up into higher and higher simplices and higher independent sets. So the question finally, the real question we're interested in today, is does the independence complex of a graph G have an L-dimensional hole? There's two things to note about this problem. The first is that the input to the problem isn't the independence complex itself, it's the graph G. And that's important because the graph G will always give an efficient description of the independence complex. The second thing to note about this question is that it's not the question I had on the title slide of the talk. So on the title slide of the talk, I spoke about the clique homology problem, and here I'm referring to the independence homology. And the clique complex is another complex, simplicial complex, that is again defined by a graph G, where now instead of defining the complex by the independent sets of the graph, you define it by the cliques of the graph. And the reason the talk is called the clique homology problem is because it's the clique homology problem that is really interesting for kind of practical applications. But the reason I've introduced the independence complex here is that it's via the independence complex that we can see the link with supersymmetry most easily. But luckily, it turns out that these two problems are computationally exactly equivalent. So if you give me a circuit for solving the independence homology problem, I can use that circuit to efficiently solve the clique homology problem and vice versa. So today I will use the two terms slightly interchangeably, depending on which one's more convenient, but just bear in mind that computationally they're equivalent. And if you want to have a picture in your head, keep this picture in your head. This is the one that will help for the talk. Okay, so we've got these two problems. They're computationally equivalent, but why should we care about either of them? Why are they interesting? It turns out that clique homology has applications for topological data analysis. So this is a practically useful problem. There are actually people in industry sat around trying to make better algorithms to solve this problem. And that means it's interesting to understand its complexity, understand the limits of what people can actually do to improve these algorithms. And in particular, it's interesting to understand, is this problem characterized by quantum complexity classes? And is there hope of quantum advantage for this problem? I.e., will quantum computers solve this problem more efficiently than classical computers can? Because if so, that would give us, you know, a nice practical use case for quantum computers that doesn't directly involve kind of simulating many-body physics. On that note, there is a quantum algorithm for a closely related problem. So it's not exactly the clique homology problem, but it's a problem that gives us some information about the answer to that problem. And those of us working quantum information theory will remember a few years back the kind of great dequantization by Yiwen Tang. So a few years ago, a very smart master student came along and showed that there were lots of algorithms which we thought were use cases for quantum computers that actually could be efficiently run on a classical computer, which was a disappointing result for those of us in the field. But this algorithm withstood that dequantization. And that raises a question. Is there some fundamental reason why this algorithm cannot be run on a classical computer? Or is it just that no one's come along with the right tools to dequantize it yet? So the kind of only way really to tackle that question is to understand the complexity of this problem and related problems. And, you know, if we can show that this algorithm can't be dequantized, it would show an algorithm that isn't immediately directly related to quantum mechanics where there is quantum advantage. What was known about its complexity before this work? As I said, its complexity has been an open question for many years. So it was first posed formally back in 2002. And it's been essentially an open question since then. So back in 2016, it was shown that this problem is classically hard. So both simplicial homology and clique homology were shown to be classically hard in 2016. Well, when I say something's classically hard, what I mean is that it's at least as hard as the hardest problems that can be checked on a classical computer. Now, we don't think that everything that can be checked on a classical computer can be solved on a classical computer. So this means it's very, very unlikely that this problem can be solved efficiently by a classical computer. But this only gave a lower bound on its complexity. We know it's at least as hard as those problems, but it could be much, much harder. In particular, we don't know if this problem can be checked efficiently on a classical computer. I should say, initially, this result wasn't shown to hold in the regime where we expect the quantum algorithm to perform well. Although a few days after our result appeared, another result appeared that also showed clique homology is classically hard in the regime where we expect the quantum algorithm to perform well. What's our main result? So informally, our main result is that clique homology is quantumly hard. And it retains its hardness when restricted to the regime where we expect the quantum algorithm to perform well. And when I say it's quantumly hard, I mean it's at least as hard as kind of the hardest problems that can be solved efficiently that can be checked efficiently on a quantum computer. So for kind of complexity theorists, there's a slight subtlety here. We've shown QMA1 hardness rather than QMA hardness, but I'll discuss that a bit later in the talk. And I just note this is, again, a lower bound on the complexity. We haven't fully pinned it down. But I will talk again at the end of the talk about we're very close to pinning down its complexity a lot more precisely. And as I kind of alluded to on the first slide, the answer to why this seemingly completely classical problem should be related to quantum complexity classes comes through a link with supersymmetric quantum mechanics. And this link is one which we hope, you know, to use to derive more results in the future. Okay, so for the rest of the talk, I'm going to start by giving an overview of quantum complexity theory so that I can actually explain the results slightly more rigorously. I'm then going to define the homology problem more formally and explain how this is connected to supersymmetric quantum mechanics. I'm going to give an overview of the proof. I won't go through the kind of the nitty-gritty details, but I'll hopefully give you some intuition for how we came to the final result. And finally, I'll talk about some open questions. So first of all, quantum complexity theory. What are we trying to do in quantum complexity theory? Well, just like in classical complexity theory, we want to understand what classes of problems are easy and hard for quantum computers. Perhaps the most interesting complexity class in quantum complexity theory is a class BQP. And this is the class of problems that can be solved efficiently on a quantum computer. Unfortunately, I'm not going to talk about that class today, and that's because we don't think clique homology can be solved efficiently on a quantum computer. Instead, I'm going to talk about the class QMA and a slight generalization of this class. So QMA is essentially the class of problems that can be checked efficiently on a quantum computer. So more formally, what that means is we're going to consider QMA as a set of problems that have yes or no answers. And what we're going to say is that if we're in a yes case of QMA, so if we're asking a question and the answer is yes, then there exists some witness in the form of a quantum state such that if you give me that witness, I can run an efficient algorithm on my quantum computer that will, with high probability, confirm that this is a valid witness, confirm, yes, we're all okay, you should accept this answer. We do allow some probability that the quantum computer says no accidentally. But if we're in a no situation, so if the actual answer to this problem is no, there does not exist any quantum state that will fool my quantum computer into accepting, except with very low probability. Okay, so this is a quantum complexity class QMA. But today we're going to be interested in a slight modification of this complexity class. And this is a class called QMA1. So QMA1 is what's known as a one-sided error version of QMA. So very, very similar definition to the class QMA, except that now, in yes instances of the problem, we're going to require that my quantum computer tells me to accept 100% of the time. We don't allow any probability of error if the true answer to the question is yes and I'm given a valid witness. If the true answer is no, we'll still say my quantum computer can tell me to accept with small probability, but if it's yes, I always have to accept. So clearly, this complexity class is contained within QMA. It's not clear whether the two classes are equal. I think some people think definitely yes, some people think absolutely not. I wouldn't say I had a strong opinion either way. But for today, this is the class that we're mainly going to be interested in. I should say this one-sided error does introduce some subtleties. And the subtlety we're going to be concerned with today is the choice of universal gate set. So there are many choices of universal gate set you can choose for your quantum computer to use. Normally, in quantum complexity theory, it doesn't matter what universal gate set you use. And that's because any one universal gate set can simulate, within small error probability, any other universal gate set. So if we're concerned with the class QMA, it doesn't matter which universal gate set we use, because switching between gate sets will only introduce a small error, and errors are allowed in our definition of our complexity class. But with a complexity class QMA1, these small errors could take us outside of the class. And that's because, remember, in QMA1, we have to accept with no error in yes cases. So the class QMA1 is thought to be dependent on the gate set used. So a common choice of universal gate set is the gate set shown on the screen. I'm not sure there's any particular reason it's the most common, except that it was the one used in the first paper that defined the class. And you know, it's a good gate set. Except for us, it's not a good gate set for us. And the reason it's a bad, well, there's two reasons it's a bad gate set for us. This irrational square root of 2 in the Hadamard gate causes problems, and so does the imaginary number in the T gate. So we're going to use a different universal gate set that only has real rational coefficients. And we can do that by using the gate set C0, U, and Toffoli, where U is what we call the Pythagorean gate here. And you can see why we called it the Pythagorean gate. Any Pythagorean triple will do to define such a gate. And it's known that gate sets such as these are universal. I should note, you know, if anyone wondering why we've used C0 and Toffoli, using C0 makes the proof slightly easier, and using Toffoli allows us to show explicitly that we can do all classical computation. So that's why we've used both gates in the set, even though just one would do. Okay, so this is a slight subtlety that comes from using QMA1 rather than QMA, and this is the gate set we're going to use to kind of overcome this subtlety. Okay, so those are the gate sets. There's some subtleties, but what sorts of problems should we think about living in these complexity classes? First of all, what sort of problems are characterized by the complexity class QMA? The kind of canonical problem for the complexity class QMA is what's known as the local Hamiltonian problem. So in this problem, you're given as input a k-local Hamiltonian acting on n spins. But when I say a k-local Hamiltonian, I just mean that each term in this sum only acts non-trivially on at most k spins. I don't mean there's any geometric notion of locality. And you're given a promise as well. You're promised that either this Hamiltonian has a ground state with energy less than A, or all its eigenstates have energy greater than B, where A and B are separated by some inverse polynomial in the number of spins. And the problem is just to decide, does it have a ground state energy less than A or not? And when I say this problem is characterized by QMA, what I mean is that this problem is inside QMA, so it can be checked efficiently on a classical computer, and it's the hardest problem that can be checked efficiently by by a quantum computer. Okay, so that's QMA. What about QMA1? Well, the two complexity classes are quite similar, so you might think that the problems characterized by them would be quite similar too, and you'd be right. So the sorts of problems that are characterized by QMA1. One example is the quantum satisfiability problem. So here, you're given a sum of k-local projectors acting on n spins. So here, we don't allow the terms in the sum to be general anymore. We enforce they have to be positive semi-definite. So for example, projectors, although other positive semi-definite matrices would do. And this time we're promised that either there is a zero energy eigenstate of this Hamiltonian, or every energy eigenstate has energy greater than B. And again, we're just asked to decide which of these two cases is the case. And you can see why this is called the quantum satisfiability problem. In a yes case, what we've shown is that all these projectors, which we can think of as constraints, can be simultaneously satisfied. And this problem is in the class QMA1, and it's, you know, the hardest problem in that class. Okay, so now I'm going to move on to talk briefly about homology and how we actually define holes formally. So, you know, I said up until now, think of a hole just as you intuitively would, but how do we make that more mathematically rigorous? Well, if you think about your intuition, we think of holes as being cycles. And, you know, we think of them as being closed cycles. But they don't bound anything. There's nothing that the hole is a boundary of. And that's, you know, I think what most of us would intuitively think of as a hole. So in order to go from this intuitive definition to a more mathematically rigorous one, I'm going to introduce a boundary operator. Now, this boundary operator can be defined for kind of general chain complexes, but here I'll just introduce it for simplicial complexes. So the boundary operator acts on a simplex just as you'd expect. You give it the simplex, it gives you the boundary of the simplex. So if you act with the boundary operator on a 2-simplex, it gives you the 3 edges that bound that 2-simplex. Now you can extend this by linearity to acting on complexes or sums of simplices, as we've done in the bottom picture here. So we've acted with the boundary operator on the 3 edges that bound the 2-simplex, And we found that this object has no boundary. And intuitively, from the pictures, this is, you know, is giving us a boundary. This is what we expected to happen. And there are two important mathematical properties of the boundary operator. The first is that cycles don't have boundaries. So any cycle, if you input it into the boundary operator, you'll get zero out. And on a related point, the boundary of a boundary will always vanish. Okay, so how do we go from this to a rigorous definition of a hole? Well, we said a couple of slides ago that holes are cycles. That means that holes live in the kernel of the boundary operator. We also said that holes aren't the boundary of anything. So that means that holes aren't in the image of the boundary operator. If we put these two things together, we find that holes in a simplicial complex are in one-to-one correspondence with elements of the homology group, where the homology group is the kernel of the boundary operator, quotiented out by the image of the boundary operator. So the kind of formal question we want to know the answer to then, our formal kind of computational question, is to ask whether a particular homology group is trivial or not. Okay, so whistle-stop tour to homology. Now we're going to talk about supersymmetric quantum mechanics. And apologies, I'm sure there's lots of people in the audience who know a lot more about supersymmetry than I do, but I'll go through this quickly for kind of the quantum information people. So we're going to start with a Hilbert space, which we can decompose into a direct sum of bosonic and fermionic modes. When we say a system is supersymmetric, what we mean is that there is a symmetry that pairs up bosonic and fermionic states. So this symmetry is going to be introduced by the supercharge Q that just takes us that just kind of flips the fermionic and bosonic Hilbert spaces. N equals 2, SUSY quantum mechanics, enforces that this supercharge squares to give us zero. You might be noticing now there's some hint of homology coming in here. In homology, it was important that the boundary operator squared to zero. You can see here we've got an operator that squares to zero. So, you know, you can see some hints of homology beginning to creep in already. The Hamiltonian of our supersymmetric system is given by the anticommutator of the supercharge Q and its Hermitian conjugate. And from this definition, it's very easy to check that the supercharge commutes with the Hamiltonian. And this means that the supercharge is a symmetry of the Hamiltonian. So what does this mean in terms of the actual properties of the Hamiltonian, in terms of its spectrum? What it means is that every non-zero eigenstate of a supersymmetric Hamiltonian will come in a bosonic fermionic pair. So every non-zero eigenstate of a supersymmetric Hamiltonian will have degeneracy at least 2, and it will have an even degeneracy, and each fermionic eigenstate can be mapped to a bosonic eigenstate by either the action of Q or Q dagger, and vice versa. And this property comes out very easily just from studying the Hamiltonian. But this isn't true for zero energy eigenstates. These eigenstates are special. So zero energy eigenstates are what we're going to call supersymmetric eigenstates. And it can be seen kind of very quickly from studying the Hamiltonian that these zero energy eigenstates are in the kernel of both Q and Q dagger. Oh, sorry. And what this means is that the supersymmetric ground states correspond to the elements of the homology group of Q. And the reason for that is, well, clearly, the supersymmetric ground states are in the kernel of Q from this equation, but they cannot be in the image of Q, because if they were in the image of Q, then Q dagger acting on them wouldn't vanish. So we find that supersymmetric ground states are again in one-to-one correspondence with elements of homology. So this tells us that is the homology group of K non-trivial? Is the same question as is the SUSY Hamiltonian with the boundary operator as its supercharge satisfiable? Remember, we're not interested in general homology groups of general simplicial complexes. We're interested in homology groups of independence complexes. So can we find a supersymmetric quantum system that maps nicely to the independence complex? And the answer is yes. And it's a very nice, simple, supersymmetric model. And it's a model called the Fermion Hardcore model. As you might expect, it's defined on a graph G. And this graph G is kind of the sites for fermions to kind of hop around. And it's called the fermion hardcore model because the fermions in this model have what's known as a hardcore condition. And this enforces that you can't have two fermions on adjacent sites in the graph, where we say that two sites are adjacent if they're connected by an edge. What this means is that the Hilbert space of the model is given by configurations of fermions on the graph such that no two fermions occupy adjacent sites. In other words, the Hilbert space is given by the independence complex of the graph. You can also show that the supercharge of this model is exactly the boundary operator of the independence complex of this graph. So putting all of this together, what it means is that the question, does the independence complex of a graph G have a hole, is the same question as, is the fermion hardcore model defined on this graph G satisfiable? Okay, so that's kind of covered all the background. Now we can go on to give an overview of the proof. As you might have guessed from the slightly leading introduction, the way we're going to try and prove this is by showing that the question of whether the independence complex of a graph has a hole is at least as hard as the question of whether a quantum Hamiltonian is satisfiable. And the way we do that is by showing that if we had an algorithm to solve the satisfiability problem, it would imply an algorithm to solve the independence homology problem. So before I go into the proof, I'll just talk very briefly about how it was shown that quantum satisfiability was QMA1 hard. So the way this was shown was by taking an arbitrary QMA1 verification circuit and from it constructing a Hamiltonian such that in yes instances of the problem, this Hamiltonian was satisfiable, and in no instances of the problem, this Hamiltonian had minimum energy lower bounded by a polynomial in the size of the problem. And that's just shown by these two graphs here. So in yes cases, satisfiable. In no cases, every state has high energy. So what is this Hamiltonian? It's a slightly scary looking Hamiltonian. Don't worry, we don't need to understand the full details of it. I just want to pick out a couple of properties of it. So what this Hamiltonian is doing is it's encoding the history of the computation into local terms. So you can see the H-in and H-out terms here. They just enforce kind of the boundary conditions at the beginning and the end of the computation. The clock terms just ensure that there's kind of an idea of time ticking away in our Hamiltonian or in our state so that we can keep track of the time in the history of our computation. The terms that are interesting for us are these H-prop terms or these propagation terms. And these are the terms that encode the actual computation that's carried out in our circuit. So the important thing about these H-prop terms, as I said, is that they encode the computation. They encode the computation of the circuit. So our first proof idea, when we started tackling this problem, was to take this quantum satisfiability, which we know is QMA1 complete for general local Hamiltonians, and show that it retains its hardness when we restrict the fermion hardcore model. So the fact that this problem is QMA1 complete doesn't alone imply our result. And that's because just because the general problem is quantumly hard doesn't mean that every example of the problem is quantumly hard. I can write down some very simple Hamiltonians which this problem is easy for. We wanted to show that the fermion hardcore model isn't one of those examples, that there is no nice, simple, sorry, that there is no way to no way to answer this problem simply, and this problem is as hard as the general problem. Initially, we thought we'd do this using a technique from quantum complexity theory known as perturbation gadgets to kind of take our nice, simple fermion hardcore model and use it to simulate a slightly more kind of complicated-looking model that would allow us to show hardness. And the really nice thing about this proof technique is that it would allow us to show not only the independence homology result that we have, but it would also allow us to show that every other complexity result we have for local Hamiltonians applies to the fermion hardcore model. The less nice thing about this proof technique is that it doesn't work. Or at least we couldn't get it to work. Maybe there's someone else in the audience who can, but we spent some time on this and we couldn't get it to work. And the difficulty really is in designing these perturbation gadgets. So I think it's fair to say that in quantum complexity, you define perturbation gadgets to simulate kind of complicated Hamiltonians with simple ones by some educated guessing about how these Hamiltonians should look. And we couldn't get that to work for our case. Instead, we came up with a second proof idea. And this proof idea kind of bypasses the supersymmetry. It uses supersymmetry as inspiration, but then it goes back to what we're actually dealing with, which is holes in simplicial complexes. So the idea is we construct a graph that has 2CN holes. And these 2CN holes are going to be the Hilbert space of n qubits. We then construct gadgets which fill in holes corresponding to the projectors in quantum k-sat. So the idea is that for each local term in the Hamiltonian, in the hard quantum k-sat Hamiltonian, we're going to construct a gadget that we can glue onto our graph that will fill in the hole corresponding to that state. And then for any QMA1 verification circuit you give me, I can construct the corresponding Hamiltonian, and then I can construct the corresponding graph. If we're in a yes instance for the QMA1 problem, the Hamiltonian will be satisfiable, and that means the graph will still have a hole, because we've only filled in the holes that correspond to holes that are filled in, that correspond to states that are lifted in the quantum Hamiltonian. Whereas in no cases, every state for the quantum Hamiltonian will be lifted, and this means that every hole in our complex will have been filled in. And therefore, you know, the answer to the independence homology question will be no. The nice thing about this, this proof idea is that we don't have to do any kind of guessing of what do we think the graph should look like to fill in different states. Instead, we can really just look at the holes and fill them in. So in order to do this reduction, we have to construct graphs to fill in the holes that correspond to all of these states. Now, I'm not going to take you through how we can actually do this construction. Instead, I'm just going to take you through the three different types of holes we had to fill in, going from the very simple ones to the much more complicated ones. So first of all, what is our very holy graph, our graph with where the independence complex has 2n holes? It's a very simple graph. It's just a graph of n disconnected triangles. And you can think about each of these triangles kind of encoding a qubit. And the first type of projectors I'm going to think about are our classical projectors. So these are just listing classical states. And I should say, if we only had to worry about these projectors, we could have come up with the graphs in the other proof idea as well. These graphs are very easy to come up with. And they really are just, for whatever classical state you want to lift, you add a single mediator to the graph and connect it to a particular vertex. So this graph lifts the one state. It says this single qubit must be in the zero state. This graph lifts the zero, zero state. It said these two qubits must be in the one, one state. And this graph lifts the zero, zero, zero state. It says these three qubits must all be in the one, one, one state. Well, it also lifts all the other states apart from the one, one, one state. So as I said, these graphs are very easy to come up with. We didn't need to use this idea of filling in holes. We could have just done it in the supersymmetric picture. The next set of states we want to lift are a little bit more complicated. These are entangled states, but not kind of messy entangled states like the Pythagorean ones. So these are these states shown here in purple. And we couldn't come up with the graphs to kind of lift these without actually kind of constructing the independence complex of the graph and seeing which states we had to fill in. But once we did that, these were very easy to fill in. And the reason they were easy is because you can see all of these entangled states are added with opposite signs, so opposite phases. And also every qubit in each state is in a different state in each term in the superposition. And what that meant in our graph is that when we were filling in these holes, we always just had to fill in a copy of Sn, which is not too hard to do. So the graphs we ended up with for the states look kind of like this. This is the graph lifting the Bell state, and this is the graph lifting a three-qubit Bell state. So, not the simplest graphs in the world, but not too bad. And as I said, filling them in didn't require any special insight other than let's look at the independence complex. So if we take stock now, it looks like we've done a lot, it looks like we're nearly there. But actually, if you think back about the problem we're trying to solve, what you can show is that with all of these gadgets, all we could do is show classical complexity results. So if we stopped here, we could have shown that this problem is hard, classically hard. But we couldn't show anything about quantum hardness. And that's because these gadgets are enough to encode classical computation into our graph, but not to encode quantum computation into our graph. So to actually show quantum complexity results, we had to deal with these Pythagorean states. And these states are harder, as you might have guessed. They're harder for a couple of reasons. Firstly, we don't just have one copy of each state in here. We've got 5 and 4 and 3. We've also got some states added with the same sign, some with the opposite signs. And we've now got that, you know, some qubits are in the same state in different terms in these superpositions. And what all of this means is that when we try and construct the hole that corresponds to this state, we don't just have a nice copy of Sn. We've got some crazy messy thing that kind of comes back on itself and interlinks and is not clear really at first what it means to fill this in. So dealing with this was kind of the main technical contribution of the work. And to do it, we kind of came up with a new technique that we called simplicial surgery. And the idea here is that in order to deal with the fact that our hole we want to fill in doesn't really look like a hole, we're going to take the individual cycles and cut them open in such a way that we can then glue them back together to form a copy of Sn. We then fill in that hole, and then we quotient out by kind of the extra simplicities we've added in order to do the surgery. You might be thinking, why would that work? And the truth is, we don't have a proof that it works in the general case, but what we have done is shown that for the cases we needed, it did work. And we are working at the moment on a proof that it works in the general case. So this is the kind of technique we used, and this is the graph that we end up needing to implement to fill in one of the Pythagorean gates. The other one looks very similar. So I hope you'll believe me when I say kind of doing this just by educated guessing was hard, and I don't think it would have been possible to get this without really going back to the geometry and understanding what was going on there. Okay, so when we put everything together, what we've shown is that clique, or independent homology, are quantumly hard when you have the graph G given as input. And we're also able to show that the problem retains their hardness when restricted to the regime where Lloyd et al. Algorithm works well. And that's just using kind of circuit sparsification techniques and then applying our standard reduction. The big downside of the proof technique we used, as opposed to using the earlier proof technique, is that it doesn't allow us to show an upper bound on the complexity. And that's because we've sort of lost some of the connection with supersymmetry. And by losing this connection, we've lost any promise on the kind of lowest eigenvalue. And that means we can show its QMA1 hard, but we weren't able to show any upper bound on its complexity. However, I'm currently working on another project, again with Marcos and with Robbie King, who's a PhD student at Caltech, where we are coming up with a new reduction that also shows QMA1 hardness of the problem, but importantly does retain the promise, so it also shows containment in QMA. And the ideas use many of the same ideas, but now we have to come up with a much more complicated graph as our initial kind of cubic graph. And by coming up with a more complicated graph, we're able to kind of fill in the holes while at the same time maintaining a closer link to supersymmetry. So that should appear kind of in the next few weeks, hopefully. So that's an open question, but an open question we're close to solving. We also want to show an upper bound. So that's kind of lower bound on the complexity of the promise problem. We could also think about an upper bound on the complexity of the decision problem. So the decision problem is a problem where we're not giving any promise on any eigenvalues of matrices. And working on the complexity of that problem. Sorry, those should be the other way around. Upper bound on complexity of the promise. So the last kind of open question, which is to do with this independence homology picture, is the problem of what can we say about dequantizing the Lloyd et al. Algorithm. So I said our hardness result does apply in the case where their algorithm works well. But their algorithm is tackling a slightly different problem, so we haven't contradicted the efficiency of their algorithm. What we'd really like to do is to show that they use our techniques to show that their algorithm is among the hardest problems that can be solved on a quantum computer. It's a little bit tricky. There's some subtleties. It's not a kind of it's not a straightforward generalization, but it's a problem we're interested in and interested in working on in the future. There's also some much more speculative open questions. So this result kind of came from taking an idea from high energy physics, so supersymmetric quantum mechanics and the Fermion hardcore model, and using this in combination with ideas from maths and quantum information theory to come up with new complexity results. And I guess this is a question to the audience as well as an open question. Are there other results like this out there? So are there other interesting classes of Hamiltonians that map to interesting concepts in mathematics where we can use this connection to show interesting complexity results? And I guess the holy grail is to show not kind of another almost negative result that these things are quantumly hard, but can we find kind of a sweet spot where we can show that there exist problems that are classically hard and quantumly easy using these connections and using kind of special classes of Hamiltonians. So yeah, thank you for your time and happy to take any questions.
All right, I already see Ronak.
Hi. Yeah, so just a small clarification that I know you commented on, but I didn't understand your comment. So in your description of QSAT, you had a promise of a lower bound on the second eigenvalue. But usually, I don't think of supersymmetric quantum mechanics as having this. Is there a sense? What is the supersymmetric quantum mechanics analog of having this lower bound?
Yeah, so this is why we've only shown QMA1 hardness rather than containment in QMA or QMA1, because we don't have that promise. So, like in general quantum Hamiltonians, you don't have a promise on the lowest eigenvalue in no cases, but in order to put them into complexity classes, you have to assume you're given a promise. So the idea would be to assume we're given a promise on the lowest eigenvalue in no cases. You can phrase this in terms that have nothing to do with supersymmetry, so in terms of the combinatorial Laplacian. So you can, even with a promise, you can phrase this in a totally non-quantum mechanical way. The idea is that in order to show containment in QMA or QMA1, we'd have to assume that, you know, for this Hamiltonian, for this problem, I will promise you that one of these two cases hold, that we don't lie in between, if that makes sense.
I see. If I'm to understand, you don't know whether the Hamiltonian you constructed is gapped or not. Would that be a way to say what you said?
Yeah. That's exactly right. We don't know whether our Hamiltonian is gapped or not.
Yeah.
But the kind of Hamiltonian we're working on at the moment, we can show that it's gapped. We can't show that it's gapped. We can show that in no cases, every eigenvalue is lifted. So it's not about the second eigenvalue. It's about the minimum eigenvalue in cases where there's no zero eigenvalue.
Right.
So it's slightly different.
Yeah,
that makes
thank
sense.
You. Yeah. Thanks.
Hey, thanks. That was a beautiful talk. So you mentioned this work of Lloyd several times, but didn't say much about it. But I was just curious because you said it's similar, but then the conclusion seemed to be the opposite. So,
yeah.
Can you explain that a little?
Yeah, that's a great question. So it's a bit harder to phrase Lloyd's problem in terms of homology, but in terms of Hamiltonians, what Lloyd's question is asking is, what's the density of low-lying state? So not what is the lowest eigenvalue or is there an eigenvalue below this energy, but kind of just roughly how many eigenvalues are there below a particular energy. And it's shown that this problem is much easier to solve on a quantum computer. And in particular, this problem is complete for a class that known as DQC1. So this is a one clean qubit model of quantum computation. So the idea is that if we could show that the density of low-lying states is DQC1 hard for the Fermion hardcore model, that would be evidence that this Lloyd's algorithm couldn't be run on a classical computer. Because we think DQC1 is outside P. but it's inside BQP but outside P, so we think it's an intermediate class. Uh-huh. There were a few papers last year, kind of the second paper by Lloyd that I mentioned, plus a paper by the Amazon group and the Google group that were kind of investigating Lloyd's algorithm. And I think the consensus now is that it's an interesting algorithm, but probably not practically useful, because the regime where it works in is maybe a bit too restricted. But I think even if it's not, you know, a practically useful problem, having quantum advantage somewhere that's not obviously quantum is still interesting.
Thanks a lot.
Are there any more questions? The audience or online? If not, then let's thank Tamara again.